China is like an elephant riding a bicycle. If it slows down, it could fall off, and then the earth might quake. China's rise is a challenge unprecedented in the annals of global capitalism. The world does not have the resources to cater to 1.3 billion Chinese behaving like Americans. So writes James King in China Shakes the World, A Titan's Rise and Troubled Future and the Challenge for America. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Today, does the label Made in China mean toys made with lead and baby powder tainted with poisonous chemicals? What did the destruction of schools and tragic loss of life during the May earthquake reveal about government policies? Did the Beijing Olympics succeed in improving the world's image of China? Joining us for these and other questions about China today is Edward Friedman, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Back. Good to be here, Norm.
Welcome back, I should say.
always a pleasure to be with friends.
What are the latest revelations coming from China?
Well, I like to think of it as a country of extraordinarily intense contradictions. And the regime, which wants to maintain its absolute monopoly of power, always has a problem of how to play these contradictions. So let's take the recent example of the dairy scandal, in which the baby formula turned out to be the cause of kidney stones and too often great pain, death, God knows what else. Chinese bloggers were onto this topic in a moment, and information spread about it in all sorts of ways, in which they asked the most pointed questions about the regime. How come the Olympic athletes only got good milk and Chinese babies were dying of bad milk? Did the government care more about foreigners than it did about Chinese? Very quickly, the government shuts down all of those blogs.
Like stamping out little fires, isn't it?
That's right. And they get out their own story. Their own story is they're on top of the issue. Everybody who caused it is being fired, replaced. Maybe they'll be tried. Pictures in the paper of the premier at a hospital holding the hands of a bereaved mother. Promises that everybody will be taken care of in the hospital. And so you get this continuous interaction of the regime trying to show itself that it is on the side of the people and is your only last best hope for China's better future, and ordinary folk finding out stuff to the contrary and having access, at least for a period of time, on the blogs and webs and so on, and getting out very, very different stories. So it's a cat and mouse game. The mice scamper. It's hard to herd mice, but the cats keep winning.
And tell us about the regime right now, what sort of political system it even is.
Well, first, most important thing to know, it's not the system of Mao Zedong. There really has been a political transition. You couldn't have China's huge economic transition, making for this extraordinary market-oriented growth, a country full of entrepreneurs, a frenzy of entrepreneurs, unless the political system had changed also. So it is a society in which there is an extraordinary wide space for private action. It is a space where it is not Mao's controlled population. People are on the move all the time. The government is not worshipped as Mao was. It's always scurrying to try to legitimate itself before the population. So it remains a one-party dictatorship, but you do not have 10 million people in labor camps. You still have labor camps, but the population of them has to be 90% lower than, say, it was in the Mao era. Rather than a competition of loyalists, it's people trying to play around the edges to get out truths which they know the government is hiding. So while it's an authoritarian system, you'd have to say it's a much more successful, humane authoritarian system than it was in the Mao era. Although, because people are not deluded as they were in the Mao era, because they're much more politically conscious, you probably hear far more criticism of the system today than you ever would have heard in the Mao era.
Let's go back to the baby formula for a minute and the fact that these Chinese have complained about, well, who do you care more about, foreigners or Chinese? But wasn't the baby formula exported, and haven't these problems been getting so much attention because they're exports?
It is true that they were made into milk products, things like candy and so on. And these were exported from China, including from multinational firms. And they are all over the world, Africa, Japan, Europe, wherever you want to go. And therefore, there are cases being discovered all over the world, and they're all taking these things off the shelves. That may be a problem for the Chinese government, which cares very much about exports. But for ordinary Chinese people, they care about what's happening to their babies. And I think it is a shocking event because it's hard for ordinary people to believe that the government had information about what was going on with these poisoned products before the Olympics and chose to keep the story quiet because they didn't want bad publicity about the Olympics. And so they let Chinese keep ingesting these poisoned products. And this is just shocking, shocking as you could imagine to Chinese. What does it say about the government's priorities? Are they caring about the people at all? You get that continuing conversation, as we said, at the beginning. And if you read the blogs, they say very strong things, and you can see their shock. We have from the blogs a person who teaches film criticism inside of China. And she put on her blog one day in response to the dairy crisis something which was not film criticism, which is her normal topic, because she found she was so stunned, traumatized, unbelieving, she had to express herself on this topic. So let's hear what Sui Weiping had to say.
She calls her blog, "My Humanity is Frozen and Numb. I need to write down slowly how I feel about the baby milk powder scandal. How horrible it is that more than 10,000 babies were hospitalized and many more harmed by contaminated milk powder. What can I say? What can we say? Am I waiting for other people to say what has not been said? Looking around, I find that many friends are as trapped in silence as I am. They are also tormented by speechlessness. Are we too shocked to speak? Or have we already said what we should have said? Or is it because we can't find any words to respond to such a cruel reality? This kind of torment has actually existed for quite a long time. We are wearied by the struggle between remaining silent and speaking out. Oftentimes we can't find the right words and choose to remain silent. Will our conscience become numb and impassive if we stay silent for too long? I think it is quite possible. If that happens, it would signify the end of our morality and spirituality."
Was that blog shut down?
Any postings – the blog still exists, but any postings which touch this issue are now silenced, because when the arrow becomes pointed at the regime itself, you can't really say that. The regime isn't going to allow that. They especially don't want it being said that the regime gets its food from very separate sources from the rest of the population. So none of this stuff was devoured by the ruling groups. So they definitely don't want things like that being said. But the blog itself continues.
Have they acknowledged or addressed the charges that they, the regime, knew about the tainted baby formula before they broke the story?
No.
They're just stonewalling all of that?
No. As best one can tell from how the story is going to be played, and I think we see these things in other societies, they're going to blame lower-level people for the cover-up, and they're going to claim that the upper-level people found out too late about what the reality is. I think it's pretty clear how they're going to play the story.
The quotation I opened with about the Chinese behaving like Americans and so on, could you look at this milk powder scandal and some of the other things, such as the toys that had lead in them, and find the culprit to be capitalism and going for sort of the rags to riches sort of approach?
Yeah, well, I'm not much of a person for using words like capitalism. I never know what it means. For some, it's a rah-rah word. For others, a hiss-boo word. But if you said, does greed have something to do with it, which is, I think, something, as best I can tell, you find in all societies of the world, whatever their political system, then sure, greed definitely has something to do with it, because you can put out a product which costs you less money if you put this poison into it. It tests as if it were a high protein. That's the reason you add this stuff. It allows you to pass high protein tests. But it hasn't cost you the money that it would to actually have a high protein, so your profits will be up. So China is in the grip of an entrepreneurial frenzy. In these ways, it looks very much like what you might think of as early industrial revolution anywhere in the world. You can think back to scandals of meat and so on that Upton Sinclair wrote about in the jungle, in which you really can't trust any product at all. And I think China is sort of an extreme form of something which has occurred in all different kinds of society, whatever their political system. What's different is how it touches ruling group interests very quickly. Rather than it was the greedy corporation, you might say. Here it always threatens to touch ruling group interests. And so it's much more quickly a political kind of issue because of the nature of the system. And therefore, you get, as the woman you read, the fear that people had best be silent because you don't want to upset the authorities that be.
She talks about how she's already encountered situations like this in the past. In other words, when she writes, this kind of torment has actually existed for quite a long time. What other sorts of examples are there that are equivalent to the baby milk powder?
Well, since she's in film, the one that the people in film are all would be talking about is they're conscious of how many good movies were made by Chinese filmmakers, which the censors went over word by word, line by line, scene by scene, take this out, take that out, and often ended up saying, no, you can't show that film at all. And so they respond and say, well, why don't they pay as much attention to things which can poison and kill our babies as they do to our movies? Which is more important, to stop the poisoning of our babies or this ridiculous film censorship? So, yes, the topic is there in all parts of the society. And people within the society make connections which would not necessarily strike outsiders such as me as the connections that they would make, such as, you know, comparing the film censorship with the no control at all over the products that people have to eat.
Well, what sort of thing do they censor in the films? What we would tend to run into here, if it was going to be censored, would tend to be, you know, explicit sexual content. There, is it more politically oriented or is it both?
In China, pornography is a word that is used as a cover for political censorship. It's a kind of thing in which almost makes people want to be pornographic because they're so upset that anything gets described as pornographic in that sense, because if you can label it corrupt or pornographic, but it's a very broad definition. Polluting interests. What is a polluting interest? Well, if it says the regime isn't great, if it might say that a democracy is good, those are clearly polluting kinds of things to suggest. They are poisons which our children should not have, because were China to be a place which respected human rights and had people had protected freedoms and so on, the government's view is that we would fall into chaos, we would all be weak, and the Americans would take over. And so you're probably an agent of American imperialism, and that's why you are promoting this stuff. So it always gets back to ruling group interests.
Is America seen as China's greatest enemy?
Absolutely. It's democracy. Because – and America has a promoter of democracy. But democracy because it is still an authoritarian state. And the authoritarian state, the members who are in the regime want to benefit from the regime, who obviously I'm quite willing to believe, sincerely believe that what they're doing is best for China, do not want anything which undermines that authoritarian regime. So anything that promotes the spread of democracy is for them enemy number one. And to the extent that historically that has been the United States, then the United States is enemy number one, absolutely.
What about religion as a threat?
Religion is very complex in China because a lot of Chinese religion is very local or lineage-oriented, and that kind of religion is absolutely flourishing in China. China's in the midst of a tremendous religious revival. Buddhist gods, Taoist gods, Confucian ancestors – all of those things are totally fine, and people are very active in those kinds of things. If your religion is Lama Buddhist religion, and they are worried about the Lama Buddhist Tibetan people wanting some autonomy from China, then that religion is in trouble. If your religion is Uyghur Muslim in the far western province of Xinjiang, and they have a view that you too might want to have your own autonomous state, then that religion is in trouble. They have very complex views about Catholicism. After all, it's tied to an alien power, the Pope, and therefore it isn't patriotically Chinese. So certain things get cracked down on quite viciously, and other pieces of religion flourish extraordinarily. As I say, China quite often is simply opposites living there together.
And when we talk about the Chinese government, the sort of they you've been referring to, is personality important? You know, we think of the Mao era with the big pictures of Mao everywhere, but somehow right now, if I think of Chinese political power, it seems almost unnameable.
What you're saying is correct. Leadership obviously matters. Leadership is very important. The present president's administration, Hu Jintao, who came into office in 2002, is significantly different from his predecessor, Jiang Zemin. He's much less willing to concede to the United States on issues, much more willing to extend China's hand to Chavez in Venezuela and Castro in Cuba, but much more open to conciliation to his neighbors in Asia, much more working for cooperation with Japan and Taiwan, say, than had been his predecessor. So leadership matters, and you can have different policies. I think under President Hu since 2002, that some of the openness which had existed in the Jiang Zemin presidency, I think all human rights groups agree on this, has been lost. So leadership matters, but it's leadership within a particular political system.
And what do we know about him in particular? I don't have a sense of him the same way that some of the other leaders.
Well, I think that he's worked very hard, so you shouldn't have a sense of him. And I think what that reflects is a second thing, that the charismatic leadership of Mao is gone. Deng Xiaoping was the last survivor of the revolutionary age who had the unquestioning support of, say, the military and the whole generation of revolutionary survivors. So increasingly, you do not have an obvious leader. You do not have a leader with an obvious base of power. And so the vision that China is a place which, because it's authoritarian, it all works like grease lightning and one person gets everything that he wants, it's probably true that George Bush comes much closer to that description of a reality than the Chinese leader who has to deal, to use a different systems words, with lots of feudal lords who have lots of local power, and he has to create a consensus. And one of the possibilities is, as time goes on and as society grows larger and local interests become larger, that this problem for creating a legitimate regime will also intensify, because who is the leader and why should the leader be the leader? They have chosen the next leader. They have a presidential system similar to what Mexico used to have in its authoritarian age, where in Mexico, the president had 1 6-year term and chose his successor. In China, it's turning into 2 5-year terms. And at the end of your first 5-year term, you choose your successor. And then you have 5 years to gradually groom the successor. So the successor was given the job of being in charge of the Olympics, for example, in 2008 as a way of helping to establish his credentials for 2012 when he will take over.
We'll get further insights into China today and the forces that hold it together and the forces that tend to pull it apart when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Something you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio makes a connection to an idea that's important in your life. If you need more information, chances are you'll find it on our website, wpr.org, at your service on the web.
Let China sleep, for when she wakes, she will shake the world. A comment supposedly made by Napoleon. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Ed Friedman, and we're talking about China today. The Olympics of August. Tell us what the Chinese people hoped to accomplish, what the Chinese government hoped to accomplish in terms of world opinion, and whether they were successful.
It's actually a more complex question than most people would believe. I think the overwhelming majority of Chinese in advance of the Olympics really didn't care very much about the Olympics. What did it have to do with them? Was it going to improve their life conditions? Many people who lived in Beijing were just pushed out to make so they could build those things and were very badly treated. There was a lot of cynical comment about it. But once it happened, I think it was very difficult for most Chinese simply not to feel proud, doubly proud. Proud in terms of how it was performed, the glorious spectacle of it, and secondly, proud of how well the Chinese teams performed at the Olympic. And so I think it ended up being for what the Chinese leadership would have wanted, a feeling that they deserved to be the ruling group, a tremendous success. But those weren't the only things that occurred. On the blogs, you have many more cynical comments because they would say things such as, well, when they put on the spectacular show at the opening, well, I guess we showed to the world how many Chinese there are. In case they didn't know, there were a lot of Chinese, they know now. And then when the guy who staged the performance, Zhang Yimou, one of China's most famous film directors, was interviewed and asked in China what allowed him to put on such a spectacular success, he described how many he had to have thousands of people who he could just rip out of their normal lives. And he had to be able to control their time all the time. And they had to be able to have no place else to go and accept direction. And, for example, stay for hours underneath their placards wearing baby diapers before they would suddenly show up and hold something and be part of the spectacle. And he commented and he said, no democracy could have ever put on the performance that we did. Only one country in the world, he said, might have done it better, North Korea. And so there remained an undercurrent. But it was, I think, an undercurrent. I think the dominant view remained simply the double pride and the spectacular events, the spectacular venues, and then the great performances of the teams. But given the regime's control of the media, its ability to dominate the discourse, its tremendous successes in public relations, it is intriguing how powerful this continual sort of critical line remains in various forms in China. And it leads me, at least, not to be sure that I know what it means in the future. Because if a crisis were to occur, would you suddenly find these voices, good people such as the film critic you read, who clearly have hearts and care about the negative impacts of this kind of regime, would you find them suddenly having a much larger hearing and support than sort of public opinion indications are today when you have the regime control? So I think it's very important not to believe that we really, really know where China is going and have some feeling for the uncertainty and the multiple possibilities that remain in the situation, which worried the regime very much.
How about the protesters at the Olympics and what happened with any voices that wanted to be heard?
Well, that was very tragic. As you know, and they had promised that there would be no restrictions of human rights and people. They promised this to the International Olympic Committee. They therefore, as a result of pressure from the International Olympic Committee, set up three demonstration sites. And then there were well-meaning Chinese who thought, as always happens in China, that the government this time actually meant it. And so people who had grievances, such as they knocked down their house, corrupt real estate deal, and they built something and they got virtually nothing and they wanted a place to say, look what's happening to me, I want justice. People who are not anti-regime or anti-party but wanted justice for what happened to them, they were all arrested. They were all arrested and some remain in prison.
Well, how does it look if there's nobody demonstrating in your demonstration area?
Oh, well, they said that's because China doesn't have many problems that people have to protest again. And people who thought they had problems, they had one-on-ones with the regime representatives and they learned they really didn't have problems. So it showed that the Chinese government has better ways, harmonious ways of solving these problems in contrast to your conflictful democracies, which always make for clashes. And so what it really proved that no one ended up demonstrating is indeed that China is a wonderful, harmonious society.
What about the attitude toward America? Not just, you know, you said it remains China's number one enemy in terms of how it's viewed politically. But sometimes you have a situation, as you do with the North Korean leader, where he might like Elvis. Or what about pop culture and the way that the Chinese view American culture?
Well, the first thing is there really is a growing Asian culture, an Asian pop culture, which is very, very important. And increasingly, culture inside of China and Korea and Japan and Taiwan and Hong Kong and other places in Asia is Asian pop culture, in which they are enjoying increasingly each other's soap operas, each other's music, singers, and so on. And so I think as part of the rise of Asia and the new information technologies, that there is a much larger influence of the Asian, like Asian fusion food, Asian fusion cultures that had been in the place. And so there's simply less space for what you might have previously thought of as Asian culture. For many people, of course, it will still remain the case, though, that given how much the regime controls, the American freedom as it will be experienced is still very, very attractive.
Population control has been on the table for China for more than a generation now, more like two generations, I suppose. How successful has that been? And if they are too successful, what are the consequences?
Well, I think the regime thinks it has been successful. I think actually most Chinese think it's a good idea. They think 1.4, and I think it is 1.4 billion Chinese is too many. It means that there's too many people on too little land. It means that wealth has to be shared among too many people. Everybody would be better off if there were fewer Chinese, so moving in the direction of population control. I think it's not considered by most Chinese a bad idea. The problem becomes, of course, that it's a system which is going to impose this policy, and it's a very bad, corrupt system. And so lots of monstrous abuses occur all the time because of power holders wanting to make sure that they're delivering the proper numbers that population control demands and doing abusive things. And so you end up with forced abortions and forced sterilizations and things like that, which are not necessarily in the documents themselves. And maybe the leaders even persuade themselves that these things, if the policies were carried out properly, wouldn't happen. And it's all the result of bad people at the local level. But given the nature of the system, it's almost inevitable that nasty stuff happens. The real problem now as they look towards the future is that, as you said, Norman, over a generation now of having been imposing what is basically an urban one-child policy and more people living in the cities, in the countryside you have more than one child, that there are increasingly going to be fewer and fewer working people in the next generation. And with China being a successful people are living to ever older ages. And so there's going to be more and more people not working. China has forced retirement in many jobs, 50 for women, 55 for men. And so they're about to face a problem of a huge cohort of retired people and an ever smaller group of working people. And so they move in two directions and in response to it. One is, well, we should get a little bit of a pension system going. We should make sure that families are strong and stay together so that families take care of each other. Maybe we should lighten up on the population control policy so we have more working people to take care of the older people. No decision has been made on how to handle this at the top, but I think they're well aware that there are contradictions in difficulties ahead from the policies that they have adopted.
For a while, with the one-child-only policy, it looked as if it was promoting infanticide of girls or destruction of female embryos. Is that still?
It happens. It mostly will happen in poorest places in the countryside where the village is very small and males have to marry females from other villages. Otherwise, it will seem like incest. And therefore, if you give birth to a girl, since there is no pension system, There's a feeling that you won't have a younger generation to take care of you in your older years, and you won't, also won't have a male to help you in the fields with heavy work. And so indeed, in those kinds of situations and places, you have had instances of infanticide and so on.
Yeah. Also with the May earthquake, it showed so many parents holding up a picture of their one and only child lost when the shoddily constructed schools collapsed. And it seemed as if what we were seeing on television at that point was a lot more anger, open anger toward the government than would have been shown in the past.
I think everything you're saying is true. And so the government responded to it by shutting down the sources so you could no longer take those pictures. It banned any further demonstrations. And for people who, because they were heartbroken, as you correctly said, kept trying to demonstrate, they actually sent a few to a prison to set example for the others to stop it from occurring. And this is a problem the regime really has. That is, everybody knows that it was corrupt deals made by local party people with local construction firms in which they created what the Chinese called bean curd construction. There was no steel in anything, and so it just collapsed. You had an instance in where there was one privately built school, not from government funds, and it just stood up as strong as ever because they didn't cheat on the manufacturing of it. And you had the case of lots of other buildings in areas did not collapse. And it was precisely the public construction buildings of these things which collapsed. Now, there's no rule at the center which says go build these bad buildings. There's no reason to think that the center of the party wants to have those kinds of things happening. You would think that they would respond positively. The local people thought they would respond positively because you had these instances of local corruption. But what happens, and it's not only in this case, the regime begins by saying that's a good idea, and then they back away because if they really pushed it, they'll end up having to show that the local party is corrupt through and through. It's greedy beyond belief. It doesn't care what really happens to ordinary human beings. And that is a lot that they don't want to get out there. So even though they begin with, yes, we should clean this up, yes, we should respond to these heartbroken families, the premier goes out there and cries with the people and so on, they end up backing away from really grappling with the issue because of the nature of the political system. So once again, you see them trapped by the nature of the political system, that goodwill of good people within the bad system is really not enough to face up to the issues.
So the government is actually, assuming they have the best of intentions, caught between the will of the people and the power of the corrupt local party members.
Right, because the government remains this single party dictatorship. It rests on the base of this pyramid. And so while I believe that they have no interest in what these local people do, it just discredits the party. So I think the government, there's a lot of evidence. In fact, the government would like to do away with it and keeps trying to invent ways of ending or limiting or containing this kind of brutal corruption that goes on at the local level. So I personally don't doubt their sincerity. In their heart, they feel sincere about it. But each time they run into the problem of this is the pyramid that supports me, can I afford to see the base eroded? They end up concluding no.
I know we've moved past the Olympics, but to go back to that just for a minute and some of the environmental changes that were made to try to control the pollution, you know, shutting down some factories, trying to make it so that it would be all right for the athletes to compete. What did that suggest about the Chinese state of the environment?
Well, of course, it did point out to people who benefited from one of the reasons people in Beijing wanted the Olympics is they assumed that the government would come through on doing something to clean up the air. And since you experience the air in some of these Chinese cities as a sort of walking cancer, even if you hated the regime, you were in favor of the Olympics. It was going to mean cleaning up the air because, you know, it meant longer life for every one of your family members and everybody else you cared about in life. And I think it did try very, very hard to do something about it. They did endless things about it. in terms of banning the worst polluting vehicles, throwing out of town the worst polluting factories, going to driving even odd, so only half the number of vehicles were on the streets, shutting down every kind of energy usage within a 5-province range. And they're very serious when they were doing this. That is, you had a poor farmer who needed a diesel pump to get the irrigation running so he could have crops. And they were forced to shut down. A lot of misery is hidden because you can't get out to go interview those people, because it is a gangbusters regime. It's a Manhattan Project regime. You give them a project with an aim in which it's a matter of mobilizing resources to get it done, they'll get that project done. A little bit of debris on the side as they get it done. But they'll get that project done. But they can't stop those factories from coming back into life. They can't stop those farmers from going back to using those diesel engines. And so gradually, for worse or worse, this normality will return.
So they did pull it off for the Olympics, though. The air was relatively clean and usually polluted Beijing.
Yes, they pulled it off.
In pretty quick time, too, apparently.
Well, they began actually the closing down the factories to get rid of the worst polluting vehicles. They began things like that years ago. The closing down of the factories in the 5-province radius and the going to the limiting driving to half the amount of previous days, but you had even odd on your license plates kind of thing. That was in the last weeks, right before the Olympics. And the combination of things made for enough of a clearing up that I think you could say, well, it was, you know, it was an urban city which had a lot of pollution. It wasn't the horror that it was before. And I think most people would acknowledge that they delivered on what they promised on that one.
The water in Beijing?
Less and less every day. Less and less every day. This goes
cleaning it up.
Cleaning it up. Losing it.
Losing it, period.
Losing it. Oh, the lack of water in North China, it's worse and worse every year. It goes way back to the Mao period. And in Mao's sort of Stalinist way of doing things, you didn't care about the environmental impacts of anything. You cared about production. Production was everything. And without any kind of limits. And so they mined water without paying any attention to what it did to aquifers. I've been to places in North China where you see a dam and there's no water behind the dam. There's none at all. So they have a tremendous water problem in North China, and they did make sure they brought in water from elsewhere to take care of people during this period. But the water problem in North China is a very long-term serious problem for China. The water table keeps falling. There are cities near the coast which are going to go below sea level as they're really just falling. So North China has a very serious long-term water problem.
And what are the future of China? More on China Today when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
1-800-747-7444. Keep that number handy and call whenever you have questions about Wisconsin Public Radio programming. Our audience services staff is ready to assist you. 1-800-747-7444.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Ed Friedman. We are talking about China Today, of course, a constantly changing subject. We have dwelt on the topic of the Olympics and what a great symbol it was of Chinese success and unity and optimism. But we also hear these rumblings about how long can China last? What are the forces trying to pull China apart that this regime has to work so hard to control?
Before I answer that question, Norman, let me say a few words about the assumption of it. I think Chinese regime is a very successful regime, a very resilient regime. I think the system is very stable. It's very successful. It delivers the goods. Incomes are rising. People can be increasingly proud of China's role on the world stage. So I don't have a vision of China as a fragile place which may fall apart tomorrow. Nonetheless, the regime experiences all the problems that you said. Why? The first reason is this is a country of 1.4 billion people, which is one unitary party is trying to rule the whole place. And it can't stay control of all of the things going on. And so it's always involved, as we talked earlier, about this cat and mouse game in which the local party, often being corrupt and undermining party purposes and taking advantage of its power, is the greediest, worst element for turning people against the regime. And the regime, therefore, is always engaged in a struggle to keep the thing together. So I'd say the first problem is the whole political system, a unitary centralized political system. It would make so much sense to run China in a federalist kind of way, in which you could have local accountability, in which you really could get rid of local SOBs who you were upset by. So you ask them, why won't they do that? Well, they won't do that ideologically because federalist to them sounds a lot like feudalist. It's backward. And because they feel that their great strength is this Manhattan Project stuff, that they can mobilize for any single purpose. If they go in the federalist direction, won't they lose that ability when they have to mobilize, whether it's a space program or the Olympics or whatever it is, for that single purpose? And so the regime feels a life and death interest in not doing the things that would make the system, I think, more humane, stabler, more accountable, and so on. So they indeed are trapped, just as you were suggesting, in an issue. So I don't think it's a matter of falling apart, but I think it makes for far more problems, far greater use of unnecessary force, far greater alienation of local people who see local satraps getting away literally with murder and so on. And so the continuing problem that the regime experiences itself dealing with, the whole thing may fall apart, is inherent in the nature of the system.
Isn't the reason that, for example, so many companies are leaving America and going over to China because they can use cheap labor?
No.
No.
It once was, but China has risen. Labor prices are going up. The value of the Chinese currency is going up. With the cost of fuel going up, the cost of transportation to move the products is going up. So you are beginning to see lower-end items moving out of, say, China to Vietnam. And you're beginning to see firms which want to hold on to things closer to home because of the they don't know what's going to happen to fuel prices, beginning to locate closer to home. So I think the regime is feeling right now a need for very rapid upgrading so that they can produce and export many more higher value items. Their problem is that Mao left behind so many miserably poor people in the countryside that even though probably 300 million people have left the countryside since Mao died and reforms have begun and they're looking for better lives in the city, there's another 300 million people. Chinese numbers are mind-boggling. There's another 300 million people who really can't make it in the countryside. And the regime says, what happens if we don't have exports for them? So they still have to try to manipulate things to keep the currency low, to find lower-end jobs for those people. So they're trying to juggle both things at the same time. So while on the one hand, for example, they're very upset with the decline of the dollar because they buy lots of dollar-denominated securities and they're losing money on it. They'll end up getting less money back than they're putting in. And they get criticized in China for doing that. On the other hand, they're keeping spending money in buying dollars because they want the dollar to be high so their currency is low so they can continue to export so these people don't get upset at the regime and so the regime can stably stay in power. So whenever you really walk into Chinese situations, you always feel sort of the ping pong effect of your head going yeah. back and forth and the regime always being trapped in these contradictory forces.
So there's not work, you know, terribly low wages being paid for workers that are producing products for Walmart and other sort of huge corporations.
Walmart will do its best to keep the products as low priced as possible. But increasingly in the East Coast and urban areas, wages are going up. And Walmart has to compete if it's going to be able to hold on to its labor force. So wages will continue to go up.
It's almost a little known fact, it seems to me, that the Chinese recently had a spacewalk, their first spacewalk.
They've had their first space, not their first space shot, but their first space walk. Cool. It's a prelude to going to the moon. There's every reason to think that they'll be on the moon before we get back to the moon. They invest very heavily in it has a payoff in commerce. They are putting satellites into the sky, and they are the low price bidder for that. It also obviously has military implications and applications. Whole question of communications, which modern warfare runs by. They want to be able to shoot down those kinds of things in case of war. They're always preparing for what might be the next war. And so China, indeed, after all, it has great universities and great science and technology. And the government has been funneling money into successes of this sort. And there's every reason to see China as one of the great powers of the world. And the spacewalk is just one indication of that China is a power. You know, people will say, how can you say that? You just said 300 million are still miserably poor, living on less than a dollar a day. It's another one of those contradictions. It is a great power. It has these problems. It doesn't stop it from being a great power. If you went back to 19th century England, the England that Marx and Engels wrote about, the working class may have been miserable and miserably exploited, but England was a great power at the same time. And similar things are true about China.
Presumably the government is promoting attention being paid to its space program?
Oh, of course. Chinese will take great pride in the success of their cosmonauts. Absolutely. People do take great pride in them, so much so that the government got out the story on the cosmonauts being in space a day before the space shot actually occurred, including conversations,
that they had with the cosmonauts.
It's a public relations job. You asked whether it has an impression on the population. They work very hard to have the impression they want on the population.
What do you think the most common misconceptions most Americans have about China and the Chinese? Like, if you're just sort of overhearing many people's conversations, listening to various politicians pontificate, what do you hear that makes you think they don't understand the complexity of what they're talking about?
I think the main thing is not understood is what a great success this regime is from a world perspective and a Chinese perspective. The rise of China in one generation is something the size of which the world has never seen, that China is, at a minimum now, the other superpower. And its influence is everywhere in the world. In 2006, the Europeans were shocked when they had in place programs of conditionality for loans, which they thought was going to bring good government into Africa, their former colonies, which they follow much more closely than we follow Africa. And the Chinese showed up and they said, especially focus on the oil exporting country of Angola, said, yeah, you need $2.5 billion. The Europeans have all these conditions. We'll give you the $2.5 billion. We don't have any conditions. Just let us invest in your oil and produce the oil, and we'll pay for it at market prices, maybe even above market prices. They'll outbid in order to get control of the energy. After all, they have almost 2 trillion, that's trillion, not million or billion, $2 trillion in foreign exchange. And so I think the major misconception coming from, and it's inherent in the quote, Emily, that you read at the beginning of the show, is keeping waiting for this system somehow to deflate or go away and not to understand that China has arrived, that it is a great power, that it does have global influence. And if you don't like that influence, for example, it undermined the European effort to try to move towards human rights, democracy, and good governance in Africa. You might as well begin talking about it as a serious issue, because if you keep talking about it and not understanding that China really, really is a great power and it is increasingly being experienced that way all over the world, then you can't even have a serious conversation about what your China policy should be, because you won't even appreciate what China's influence actually is.
All right. In a couple of minutes, what should our China policy be?
The truth is, I don't know. But I am not against maximum engagement with China. I am not against accommodating China, meaning allowing it into bodies which make larger global decisions as long as it carries the weight and puts up the money like everybody else and restricts itself once against the global interest. I'm in favor of engagement and accommodation. But I think that by not treating the rise of China seriously, we are going to pay costs such as the undermining of human rights and democracy and a retreat of democracy in the world, which will make the world a much more dangerous place in terms of what kinds of regimes are going to be in power. And only if you begin to think about what this China rise seriously means can you allow the engagement and accommodation, because it has risen, that there's nothing you can do about it. It's just a fact. You can't wish it away. You're not going to attack it. You can't undermine it. China is not a banana republic. It is a great power. But it does have costs, and I think the costs are very, very high, and it's worth separating the two. Yes, we want the whole world to benefit from the good stuff. It expands wealth. Two-thirds of the poverty abolished in the world since 1980 is the work of China. I want them to actually succeed in Africa and abolish some poverty in Africa. I think that would be a good thing. I wouldn't – if they could succeed, why would I be against that? But there are these other kinds of costs, the undermining of human rights and democracy, which I think is – they've totally defeated the international human rights regime. Every leader in the world from the democracies all showed up, with the exception of the Czech president, if you care, at the Olympics, paid their homage to the Chinese rule, and did not say a word in public about what had just been going on to Tibetans, which were brutal, or what was going on to the parents who were protesting against the shoddy construction which had killed their kids. They were absolutely silent. And so you are seeing an appeasement of these worst-case tendencies. So yes, engagement, yes, accommodation, but you got to find a way to not appease these kinds of nastiest consequences from the regime.
Is China simply spending its way out of criticism?
It doesn't have to quite spend, because you are seeking its spending. You want it to invest in your country. So you self-censor. Again, to go back to the film critic that Emily read at the beginning, she says most times she finds she silences herself. That's the usual thing. You silence yourself because you want the benefits of this great power. By the way, the same thing is not just about China. People in the world might not have been happy about George Bush invading Iraq, but they still want to get on with the United States government and with the United States business and so on. And so there's just a limit to how much you take on or criticize great powers, even France. You want to have good relations with the great power. You must understand that that's going to be the case with China too. So what do you do, not just with China, but with any great power, when there are negative consequences too? How do you deal with them at the same time? My only point is that if we don't acknowledge that China is that kind of a power, we can't even have this conversation about what you do about the negative consequences.
Ed Friedman, we're going to have you back in a few months and see what else has arisen out of China. Thanks for enlightening us, as always.
It's always a pleasure to be with the two of you, Norman and Emily.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.